So I'm going to call the case immediately, go out, get the file, and I shall return. The case is 99-0951, Joan LaRocque versus the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. The proceeding will be as follows. Gerald Hill, Attorney Hill, will have 10 minutes representing Joan LaRocque. Jennifer Nutt Carlton will have 15 minutes representing Joan LaRocque. And Thomas Creeran will have 30 minutes representing the Department of Revenue, and we will have a 5-minute rebuttal by Attorney Carlton. Correct? All right. So, Mr. Hill.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Gerald Bill Hill. I and my co-counsel, Jennifer Carlton, represent the petitioner appellant in the case before the bar, Joan LaRocque. I will address the issues of the principles of inherent tribal sovereignty as first announced in Wooster v. Georgia in 1832 and as reiterated by Justice Thurgood Marshall in McClanahan v. Arizona State Tax Commission in 1973. We believe that this establishes the standard of review for state taxation of the income of reservation Indians. My co-counsel will argue that the petitioner, Joan LaRocque, is a reservation Indian, that the Duro Fix, the amendment to the Indian Civil Rights Act, shows the present congressional intent regarding non-member Indians on the reservation. She will finally recite the history of taxation of reservation Indians in other jurisdictions. Inherent tribal sovereignty was first announced by Justice John Marshall in Wooster v. Georgia, recognizing the sovereignty of tribes and setting forth existing limitations at that time. The term domestic dependent nations referring to tribal governments was first announced then and has been since followed in other cases. It was in the McClanahan versus Arizona State Tax Commission in which the Justice Marshall reiterated the limitations and reciting the anomaly that Indian tribal governments and Indians have in the United States, often referred to as the unique status of Indians and how they're different with regard to regulation and the relationship that they continue to maintain with the federal government. He in his analysis of Wooster v. Georgia, recited the residual categories of tribal jurisdiction, meaning those areas of jurisdiction that have not been taken away by some particular act of Congress, and set forth categories regarding both situs and status of the taxpayer in question. It was announced the requirement and has been restated in other cases that there must be specific congressional authority that announces any particular grant of jurisdiction to states over Indians. It's also establishing the uniqueness of the relationship in that Congress has with Indians going back to the Constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, also known as the Indian Commerce Clause. In 1886, this clause was interpreted to show the plenary power of Congress in Indian matters. Since then, there have been various cases in which this doctrine has been interpreted, including the areas of taxation, and we will be discussing and addressing some of these other areas of taxation. our case today is specifically addressing the matter of the taxation of the income of Joan LaRocque by the state of Wisconsin.
And you refer to Ms. LaRocque as a reservation Indian in that she is an Indian, does live on a reservation, but she is a member of, and I'm using this loosely, of a tribe not on this reservation.
That's true, Your Honor. We stipulated to that in the with the Department of Revenue when she first challenged this ruling against her. We stipulated that she's a Menominee Indian living and residing on the Oneida Reservation.
Formerly married to an Oneida.
Formerly married to an Oneida.
And her children would be considered members of the Oneida tribe?
The children have been enrolled in the Oneida tribe, but they're eligible also to be enrolled in the Menominee tribe.
Now, suppose she had been married, would she then be considered an Oneida?
No, she wouldn't. One of the features of inherent tribal sovereignty is a recognition of difference between Indian tribes and Indian communities, and it's a matter of pride as well as blood that people identify with the origins of their parents. In this case, Joan LaRocque is a Menominee Indian, and she's quite proud of that. For purposes of our analysis, we're saying that the cases are really holding that she be a reservation Indian maintaining tribal relations on the reservation, which she has done. We've also stipulated that the Oneida Reservation is Indian country for all intents and purposes, as is the Menominee Reservation.
Mr. Hill, just recently there was a Minnesota case, it's the Topash, T-O-P-A-S-H, where formerly in Minnesota, as I understand the law, that the state did not have jurisdiction to tax if a Indian was living within an Indian reservation but was enrolled in a different tribe.
Yes.
Now they, just recently, I think in the last year, that was overturned because they said there was a distinction between a non-member and Indians who are members of the tribe on the reservation that they reside. That's the holding of the case.
Yes.
Now, do you take issue with that? In other words, as I understand it, one of the arguments made by either yourself or Mika's brief is that the Menominee and the United Tribes by treaty had a, quote, confederation, or there has been alliance or extensive relationships. Does that make any difference as far as whether they're a member of the Oneida Menominee or just the fact that they're living on a reservation as a member of the Indian being a homogeneous group?
I think that there's two parts to the question, Your Honor. The part regarding the formal treaties between the Oneida Nation and the Menominee Nation really have little effect other than to show the relationship between the communities. Subsequent treaties between the Menominees in the United States and the Oneidas in the United States were for the purpose of carving out specific areas for residencies of their respective members. Nevertheless, the relationship has gone on between them.
Would it make a difference if, say, it was a, well, let's say a Sioux or Apache from south, you know, the southwestern part of the United States rather than an Oneida who had a stronger relationship with the Menominees?
Well, we're not here making that argument, but I think it would be very similar under our analysis, since we're saying that reservation Indian, as the court below said, was recited throughout the McClanahan opinion but never defined. And for our purposes, we're talking about the petitioner here as being a member of a state tribe and claiming the exemption under Wisconsin law. As to the Topash case, it was overturned, I believe, in an opinion that regarded a criminal matter. And that case was specifically, I regard the language there as saying something like specifically reversed the first Topash case that, of course, we had relied on. My colleague will address the particulars of that particular case.
If this family needed social services, who would provide it? The tribe or the state?
Well, as her resident on the Oneida Reservation, she would be eligible to receive services of the tribe. Of course, as to her family, they would automatically be accorded the benefits of those services as a result of their membership in the Oneida tribe.
But what I'm trying to get at is, one of the concepts in the cases is that if you get the benefits of state services, you ought to pay state taxes. Mm-hmm. It seems fair to me.
Well, and we don't quarrel with that. We think that, of course, all citizens that receive state services should pay state taxes. In this particular matter, we're talking about a reservation Indian deriving their income from Indian country. And the objection in the beginning from the petitioner was that the ruling of the Department of Revenue was that when she left the Menominee Reservation, she was in fact not an Indian anymore. She was in the shoes of any non-Indian person, which except for coming on to other Indian country, that would be true. And any Indian that lives outside the reservation in areas outside of Indian country pays the same taxes as any other citizen of the state.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Your time is up by the red light. Ms. Carlton?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Carlton, and I, along with Gerald L. Hill, my co-counsel, are representing Petitioner Joan LaRocque in this matter. I'll be addressing 3 points for the Supreme Court today. First, that Joan LaRocque is a reservation Indian, as that term has been defined by the Supreme Court, and is therefore not subject to the state of Wisconsin's income tax. Second, that Congress acted in 1990 to legislatively confirm that a state has no inherent jurisdiction over Indians in Indian country, regardless of their tribal affiliation. The third point I'll be addressing is out of the 9 states that have specifically addressed this issue, a 2/3 majority have adopted a rule recognizing that a state may not tax the income of an Indian when the income is derived from Indian country and the Indian resides in Indian country. Joan LaRocque is a reservation Indian. This involves 2 concepts, status as an Indian and the situs of the activity that the state is seeking to tax. First, I'll address status as an Indian. Congress has defined the term Indian to be all persons of Indian descent who are members of any recognized Indian tribe, residing within the present boundaries of any Indian reservation. Congress has utilized this definition not only in terms to define its relationship with Indian tribes and Indian individuals, but also to define the contours of the state's relations with Indian tribes and Indian individuals. Whether this court views Joan LaRocque as an Indian in terms of her ethnicity or because of her socio-political ties to a sovereign nation, she is an Indian for the purposes of the McClanahan exemption. Next, we address the situs of the activity the state seeks to tax. This is the reservation part of reservation Indian. In this case, we're talking about the taxation of income. Consequently, the residence of the taxpayer must be reviewed to determine if the entity seeking to tax the individual confers the privilege of domicile. You see this analysis most recently by Judge Crabb in Lac de Flambeau v. Zeisky, which came out about a month ago. And that particular case dealt with an Indian that was residing on a reservation but was actually working out of state. And Judge Crabb ruled that the state had no ability to tax that income because the state did not confer the privilege of domicile on that individual, and drew a distinction between Indians that reside in Indian country and Indians that reside in the state. When Indians reside in the state, they are presumed to receive all the benefits that state residence confers.
What case is that?
It's Lac de Flambeau v. Zeisky. It came out September 8th of 2000.
Have you supplied that to the court?
Excuse me?
Did you supply a copy of that case to the court?
No, I did not, Your Honor. I became familiar with this case, and it was too late to supply that to the court.
Is it published or is it not published?
It is published.
In federal sub, do you have a reference?
No, I do not.
Okay. And how do you spell defendant?
Kate Zeisky would be from the Department of Revenue.
I'm sorry, right. Okay. I can spell that.
In fact, Your Honors, Congress has never distinguished between members of Indian tribes based on their tribal affiliation. Contrary to the assertions of the state, Congress has never made such a distinction, has never provided services, has never defined the role of the state based on tribal affiliation. Congress specifically spoke against this distinction in 1990 in the Public Law 102-137, more commonly referred to as the Duro Fix. In Duro v. Reyna, the Supreme Court held that an Indian tribe had no criminal jurisdiction over a non-member Indian. With all deliberate speed, Congress acted that same year to overturn Duro v. Reyna. In that Duro Fix, if you review the House of Representatives Conference reports and the State Representative Congress reports, Congress notes that we do not speak of members of a tribe, but of the race generally, of the family of Indians, and it is intended that these tribes be governed by Indian usages and customs, and that their action was premised upon the reality and practice of reservation life, that there were intertribal relations, marriages between tribal members, BIA representatives that were Indian, had in fact received a hiring preference from the federal government to be hired as a BIA representative regardless of their tribal affiliation, and then would be located on a particular Indian tribe. Since that time, since 1990...
Ms. Carlton, if I might interrupt for a minute or two, is your argument in regard to the so-called Duro Fix tied to the idea that in some way that's a preemption by the federal government in regard to Wisconsin?
No, Your Honor, we're not arguing that it's a preemption. In fact, the preemption is derived when the Indian country was created. The Supreme Court went through an analysis in its Venati case from 1998 in which it noted that when Congress acts to create Indian country, then it's exercising its plenary authority over the relationship between Indians and the federal government. That is the preemption that we are arguing. Duro is simply an indication of Congress's continued recognition of its plenary duties and authorities over all Indians within Indian country, not just tribal members over a particular reservation.
Well, it's my understanding that there's a presumption against preemption, and the approach that's taken is that there has to be a clear showing to override that presumption. Where do you find that clear showing in the law?
Actually, the presumption is in favor of a preemption against state taxation. State tax is presumed not to apply to a reservation on reservation activities unless the state can point to specific congressional action that have awarded it jurisdiction over Indian country.
What authority do you cite for that?
We don't cite any authority that the state has the ability to tax Joan Rock. And the state has offered no cite and no authority to indicate that Congress has specifically acted.
What authority do you cite for the contrary presumption that you've just given us?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. The presumption.
What we need is a framework here. So you start out with the framework that unless the state says expressly it's going to tax, if I understood you, and I think this is what Justice Crooks is getting at, that if they don't say they're expressly attacking, the presumption is, taxing, the presumption is they don't have the power to tax. Where do you get that presumption from? Does it come from McClanahan?
Yes, it comes from McClanahan, as well as the companion case to McClanahan decided the same day, the Mescalero Apache Tribe v. Jones.
Okay.
And the Supreme Court specifically noted in that case, in the special area of state taxation, absent cession of jurisdiction or other federal statutes, there has been no satisfactory authority for taxing Indian reservation lands or Indian income from activities carried on within the boundaries of a reservation. And McClanahan lays to rest any doubt in this respect by holding that such taxation is not permissible absent congressional consent.
What page are you reading from, Council?
From Mescalero Apache Tribe v. Jones. The site is 411 U.S. 148, and that's the companion case to McClanahan.
And where does the U.S. Supreme Court get that language? Does it cite something?
That is the first time that that language appears. It is subsequently cited in various cases, Yakima, Chickasaw cases after that. That is still the rule. You can actually see this play out in the Supreme Court's line of cases. What the Supreme Court looks for is a sufficient nexus between the individual and the activity, and the actually what they prefer to call the per se approach or categorical approach. You have an Indian residing in Indian country who derives their income from Indian country. This creates a per se rule that the state has no authority, inherent authority, to tax that individual unless the state can point to express congressional action that has awarded them jurisdiction in these activities.
Does it make any difference whether it's an Indian of that tribe or just an Indian? That was a question I asked your colleague.
That's essentially the question we're here to speak to today, whether or not that makes a difference.
Yeah, well, that's what I...
And in the Supreme Court line of cases, sales tax cases are treated differently than income tax cases, and that is the key distinction that the Supreme Court has made. In sales taxation cases, the Supreme Court has looked to the incidence of the tax, where the tax ultimately falls. Does it fall on the tribe or tribal members within the boundaries of the reservation? If it does, then the state still has a rebuttable presumption to show that it has an interest in that taxation. And that's where you get the balancing test that the Supreme Court enunciates. However, in income taxation cases, there is no incidence of tax analysis utilized. You see this plainly in the Chickasaw case, in which both types of taxes were reviewed by the Supreme Court. That's a 1995 case. The Supreme Court was looking both at motor vehicle excise taxes as well as income taxes. For the motor vehicle excise tax, the Supreme Court first looked to who the incidence of the tax fell on. Did it fall on the Indian tribe or did it fall on non-Indians? If it fell on non-Indians, then the state would be able to presumably to tax the activity. However, the Supreme Court held in that case that the tax actually fell on Indians and the Indian tribe, and therefore the state could not utilize that tax. In the same case, the Supreme Court also looked at income taxation and whether or not the state could tax the income of individuals that were employed by the tribe but did not reside in Indian country. When the Tenth Circuit had reviewed that same income taxation, they did not distinguish between individuals that resided on the reservation and individuals that resided outside of Indian country. The Supreme Court held them in error, and that the key analysis for an income taxation is where is the residence of the taxpayer. If the residence of the taxpayer is within Indian country, then the state there is a per se rule against state taxation. And in fact...
So if I understand your argument... Your argument is, in income tax, the rule is that the state, absent some express provision otherwise in the federal or state law, the state can tax, the state may not tax an Indian who resides on a reservation or Indian country.
Correct, Your Honor.
And for the moment, we can leave it to that the income is earned on the reservation, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if Ms. LaRock were an Oneida, there'd be no problem in this case, from your view?
Presumably, although the state has never actually passed any laws to that effect.
So the problem then becomes whether these federal cases apply to an Indian who's not a member of the tribe, living on a reservation of that tribe.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there you have mixed cases, don't you?
Yes, and in fact, we argue for the bright line test that any Indian residing within Indian country in the state is exempt from state taxation when they earn their income within Indian country.
Yeah, but it's just as bright a test to say any Indian who lives on a reservation of which that Indian is not a member of the tribe is taxed by the state. I mean, either way, you can get a bright line rule.
Well, we argue that it's not a bright line rule the way that the state seeks to apply it. For example, Congress defines Indian country as in three different ways: all land within the limits of any Indian reservation under the jurisdiction of the U.S. government, all dependent Indian communities within the borders of the United States, and all Indian allotments, the Indian titles to which have not been extinguished. So initially, you see Congress defining Indian country very broadly. Furthermore, they don't define it in terms of a governing sovereign of a particular tribe or particular band. You also see Congress carving out Indian country for bands of Indians, for example, the Pueblo Indians, the Reno, Nevada Indian colony, which has no tribal affiliation at all established with it. It is simply Indians, that land is set aside for the use of Indians. And you also see mixed tribe Indian country, where there are multiple tribes on one reservation, one example being the Navajo Reservation, which encompasses four states.
Now, yours is a bright-line rule. What about the Anderson case that seems to adopt a kind of balancing concept? If you look at the pros and cons, the weights, the where the money was earned, how, what kind of services you get from whom. Do you think that applies in this case?
We argue that it does not apply. And in fact, as the Supreme Court noted in Yakima, if that test were the law, litigation would surely engulf the state's annual assessment and taxation process. If you had to look at every individual's income, where they earn that income, whether there was a congressional regulatory scheme that affected each person's employment. And in fact, this court addressed that exact issue in Anderson. I see my time is up.
You may finish that.
Thank you. In Anderson, the category, one of the factors from the category was missing. You had an Indian that was earning his income in Indian country, but did not reside in Indian country. Therefore, this court applied a balancing test rather than the categorical approach because one of the factors of the category was missing. And in that case, Mr. Anderson worked for the tribal school. So this court reviewed the congressional enactments regarding whether or not there was a comprehensive federal regulatory scheme around the issue of Indian schooling. And in that case found that that there was not such a federal regulatory scheme. With adopting the state's approach and a balancing test, you would have to look at whether or not there was a federal regulatory scheme regarding Indian gaming, as Joan LaRock is employed as a casino cashier. And obviously in this area, Congress has ruled the field as far as its relations to Indian tribes and a regulation of Indian gaming.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Thomas Creering, representing the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Mr. Creering.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Thomas Creering, and I represent the respondent, Wisconsin Department of Revenue. This case does not involve the exercise of Congress's plenary powers because Congress has never regulated state taxation of non-member Indians. There is no text of any constitutional provision or any federal statute that the court can look to in order to determine the outcome of this case. the boundaries of the state's power to tax are defined solely by court decisions. Congress has not enacted any statute overruling any court decision in the area of state taxation of non-member Indians. The decision that defines the power of the states to tax is Colville, which was decided in 1980. There was no federal legislation authorizing the tax that the state imposed in that case. In the last 20 years, every state and federal case that is considered Colville has held that state taxation of non-member Indians who reside on the reservation is permissible. The Standing Rock Sioux case, which we recently furnished the court, is the latest example. Colville determined when the exercise of state power infringes upon tribal sovereign interests. It held that since non-member Indians are not constituents of the tribe, for sovereignty purposes, they stand on the same footing as non-Indians who reside on the reservation. In his concurring opinion, Justice Rehnquist emphasized that tribal immunity from state regulation does not grant tax immunity to a non-member Indian because traditional immunity of a tribe is not based upon race, but upon principles of tribal self-government. There's no individual tax immunity because non-members of the tribe cannot participate in tribal government. Both the majority and concurring opinions in Colville indicate that state taxation of income received by non-member Indians is treated no differently than state taxation of income received by non-Indians who reside on the reservation.
Well, let's just go back. Suppose Ms. LaRocque were a member of the Oneida tribe. Would she be taxed?
No.
Why not?
Because that would be an infringement upon tribal sovereignty.
Okay. And do we find a statute that says that?
No, we don't.
So it's the common law developed by the U.S. Supreme Court that says you can't infringe tribal sovereignty.
Correct.
All right, so as an Oneida, she would not be taxed. Okay. If she were a non-Indian, no member of no tribe, and she lived on the reservation and got paid for reservation work, would she be taxed?
She would, and I think the Menominee conceded that in their amicus brief.
And that's a part of the developed common law doctrine, that is case law. Okay. So she falls in between.
Correct.
Okay. So what we're looking at here, maybe, we're looking at a concept of infringement on tribal sovereignty, on the one hand.
That has to be looked at.
Right. And on the other hand, the concept the state has interest, too, in taxing, getting money to provide services. All right. So those are the two ends, right? And Ms. LaRocque falls in this middle. Now, is there a difference between income taxes and excise taxes generally?
In terms of infringement on tribal sovereignty, I believe that there isn't.
So you think they're interchangeable, because I know that Standing Rock is an excise tax.
That's correct.
Okay. I just want to clarify what the state's position on that is. So do you think Anderson applies? In that you balance out to see what's an infringement on tribal sovereignty?
Well, probably no balancing is necessary because it's conceivable, if not likely, that the state can tax for the services it provides and that the tribe can also tax for the services it provides.
Does Oneida have a tax?
No.
Pardon?
No.
No. Okay. What services does the state provide here? I mean, now we're going into the Anderson balancing kind of thing. Okay.
Sure. Well, you know, the kind of services the state provides the same kind of services it would provide to non-Indians on the reservation. You have such things as availability of in-state tuition to universities, welfare under Chapter 49.
Yeah, but you have welfare under special Indian laws too, don't you?
Sure.
All right. What about education?
Again, you have in-state tuition available.
What about primary school?
Well, you have, to the extent that there are public schools on the reservation, state, local public schools, Indians can attend those. You also have public school choice, which would allow attendance at public schools off the reservation on a space available basis.
But otherwise, you'd attend the reservation schools.
Correct.
All right.
To the extent that there are state highways on the reservation, those highways have to be maintained. That's a service that is provided by the state.
Are there state highways?
I am not.
Not in the record.
It's not in the record.
Okay.
It's also not in the record as to any services that are provided by the tribe.
What about fire? Not in the record.
Not in the record.
So what do you think the test is?
I think the test is the test that Justice Rehnquist outlined in his concurring opinion in Colville, which is, does the person being taxed have the right to participate in tribal government? If he or she doesn't, then there's no infringement upon tribal sovereignty, and then at the very least, the state's tax is permissible.
So that's your clear bright line test?
Yes.
So they gave her the right to vote. What about somebody who's 18, has a right to vote in the state, not in tribal matters? As I understood what was said, you have to be 21 to vote in the tribe.
Well, if...
If
we're an old member of the tribe, I mean, there's no, we certainly, there's still a bright line. I mean, if you're an old member, and, you know, as you reach majority, you have the right to vote.
Three-year-olds don't have the right to vote.
But they're still enrolled members of the tribe.
So that your test really is if you're an enrolled member of the tribe, then you can't be taxed for on-reservation income.
I think that's...
Suppose the kid had a trust account, paid a lot of money.
I'm not sure I understand where you're going with that.
Well, I don't know where I'm going with it, but let's start down that road. I'm trying to test as to whether it's really sovereignty, because
If it's an old member of the tribe, we wouldn't tax the income from the trust account.
So the real test is enrolled member. And it really doesn't matter if that person participates in the tribal government. They would have the right to if they met other qualifications.
Sure.
And you know, so you wouldn't use the Anderson test?
Again, I don't think it's necessary because I think it's conceivable, if not likely, that both sovereigns would have the right to impose an income tax.
What does participate in government mean?
In the context of
in the context of the Rehnquist concurring opinion.
Justice Rehnquist indicated that non-Indians have no tradition of participation in tribal government.
Can you come to a town meeting and voice your concerns? Is that participation in tribal government?
I think you have to. It has to be more than that. I mean, I think you have to have some power granted to you by the tribe to actually make decisions on behalf of the whole.
Your definition of participating in tribal government means being able to vote.
That's part of the definition. There is, just Chief Justice Abrahamson pointed out, if you're an enrolled member of the tribe. It's not my definition. It's the one used in Colville and the one emphasized by Justice Rehnquist.
But he was the concurring opinion. Why do we care what he said?
Well,
he lost.
No. He just pointed out the logical implications of what the majority opinion was, and later.
If they wanted that, they could have said that. Did they say that?
Well, they did later on, I will point out, in the regulatory area, not the tax area, in South Dakota versus Borland, B-O-U-R-L-A-N-D, 508 U.S. 679 at 695 in footnote 15, the court held that after Montana, tribal sovereignty over non-members cannot survive without express congressional delegation.
That was regulatory.
Correct.
The tax laws seem different than the regulatory laws, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
I think that this, if the court were to decide that the state can't tax here, I think that would have spillover into the state regulation of non-member Indians. And there are a couple of cases that use reasoning similar to the argument that we're making in this case. And two of those cases, one in the criminal area, would be Call, K-A-U-L versus Steffen, 83 Fed Third 1208. And that was in the criminal area where the court held that the Tenth Circuit held that a search warrant obtained by the state of Kansas to search the premises of a non-member Indian on the reservation did not infringe upon tribal sovereignty, using much the same kind of analysis as we're advocating here. And the other one in the regulatory area, Lower Rural Sioux Tribe versus South Dakota, 917 Fed Sup 1434, that case was later affirmed by the Eighth Circuit. And the district court held that state hunting and fishing regulation of non-member Indians does not affect the sovereign interests of the tribe.
Okay, so your test is what affects the sovereignty of the tribe?
That's correct.
And your answer is only if you tax enrolled members.
That's correct.
I don't know why taxing them would affect the sovereignty. I mean, the tribe continues on. Tribe can tax also.
If it affects the sovereign interests of the tribe, then you do need express congressional delegation. If it doesn't, then it's simply a question of preemption, as Justice Crutz indicated, and there is no preemption of state taxation of non-member Indians.
Well, what I'm getting at is, if we tax a Connecticut citizen who earns money in Wisconsin, personal services, and resides here for a short time, we don't view that as affecting the sovereignty of Connecticut. Right?
I think there could be an effect. I look at it more this way. If I go to Ireland, I'm Irish, and if I just go there and earn income, and I'm a Wisconsin resident, I can still be taxed on that income.
In Wisconsin.
If I go to Ireland and become an Irish citizen, it's a whole different ballgame as to whether the state of Wisconsin can tax me. If I'm an Irish citizen, then I can participate in government. And I think that's really what Justice Rehnquist was getting at.
Okay, I'll accept that for the moment. When you've left out one, if you're an Irish citizen and are living in Wisconsin, you'd be taxed here. It wouldn't affect the sovereign country of Ireland.
It might if Ireland, if you have situations where there is different sovereigns can claim power to tax, and this may be one of those situations. And if they both impose a tax, then that's something that has to be worked out between the two sovereigns, and that's also something that Justice Rehnquist pointed out in his concurring opinion, and we do that. I mean, we have reciprocity agreements with Minnesota, and we've had reciprocity agreements with Illinois and other adjoining states.
Could the Menominees tax this woman's vote as a citizen of their, member of their tribe?
There isn't a case that answers that question, but it appears to me likely that they can.
Have you worked out any reciprocity agreements with any of the tribes?
We haven't, because to the best of my knowledge, there's no tribe that imposes an income tax, and there's no reason to work out a reciprocity agreement unless a tax is imposed.
So the state just takes the position it can tax it.
In line with Caldwell and Justice Rehnquist concurring opinion.
How much money is involved, do you know?
I really have no idea how many people or how much money is involved. And it's certainly not in the record. I'd like to, maybe along those same lines, I'd like to briefly address Duro versus Reyna. The thing I should point out is that Congress's passage of Public Law 102-137 deals only with criminal jurisdiction of tribes over non-member Indians. And I think what it's important to remember there is that in Duro, Congress had held that the tribe had no criminal jurisdiction whatsoever over non-member Indians. And what the statutory, the so-called Duro fix did was to say Congress said there is now concurrent jurisdiction, and at least that's the way the statute has been interpreted, there is now concurrent jurisdiction between the states and the tribes over non-member Indians who reside on the reservation. So Duro was really a case of exclusive jurisdiction, and I don't think that's necessarily what we have here. The other thing I should point out is Duro is the only decision of the Supreme Court that Congress has ever overruled by statute, or at least the only one that has any implications for the area of taxation that we're talking about. Again, I think that the logical implications of our position are found in footnote 15 of the Borland decision, and I think that that is really where this case also has to end up by looking at the court's reasoning there and saying that it should be applied here.
Counsel, I was just going to ask you, since you mentioned that case, if you were writing this opinion, how would you structure it? What would you say?
I would say that there is no infringement upon tribal sovereignty here.
No. Well, we'll start out with what the rule is as to the cases. You would say, one, that the test is on income taxes, whether there's an was that what you say? And you'd cite Coleman?
Yes.
All right. Then what would you say?
I think I would say that the logical extension of Caldwell, well, one thing I would say is that the other state cases and federal cases that have specifically looked at Caldwell have all upheld the imposition of state taxation of non-member Indians on the reservation.
Yeah, now say that again, slowly.
The state and federal cases that have looked at Caldwell have all upheld state taxation of non-member Indians on the reservation.
No case is held otherwise.
No case that has looked at Caldwell, at least not to my knowledge.
Okay. So you would say that if you taxed a member of the tribe on funds earned on the reservation, that is an infringement on tribal sovereignty. That would be your first line of attack, right?
Yes.
And then you would say that, but if it's a non-member Indian, it is no infringement of tribal sovereignty because they don't have any powers within the government.
Yes.
So you wouldn't go to Anderson?
Again, I'm not sure it's necessary in this case, but...
Was it necessary in Anderson? Do you think that's rightly reasoned?
I think all decisions of this court are well-reasoned.
That's very kind of you. Now let's be truthful. Do you think this one, would you write it differently? You think that it's correct? Because we have to say something about Anderson, don't we?
Sure.
Okay, so what should we say about Anderson?
Well, I still think that there's no balancing necessary here because you're only talking about state taxation of the services it provides. I'm not sure if that argument was ever made by the state in Anderson. I don't think it was. So I don't...
Well, shouldn't Anderson, if your theory is right, shouldn't Anderson have said the test as to whether you can tax a Native American is whether that tax would be an infringement on tribal sovereignty, right? This, Mr. Anderson did not live on the reservation, was not participating in reservation affairs.
He may have participated in
it. But taxing him because he lived outside the reservation is not an infringement on tribal sovereignty. Is that right? I mean, is that what the state's argument would be?
I think Carver and other cases say that, you know, if you go off the reservation to reside, you subject yourself to state jurisdiction to tax.
Because there's no infringement of sovereignty. Where do they get the rule from? I'm trying to press to see if I can find out what rules are or whether these are case by case and I can't get a theme.
You obviously have one set of circumstances or one set of factors at play when somebody, you know, you're talking about a member of the tribe who resided off reservation. Now we're talking about a non-member of the tribe who resides on reservation. And then you have different factors at play in each of those two situations.
So we could have had a very short opinion in that case. 5 lines.
You could have said the Supreme Court decision, so if you go off reside off the reservation, you subject yourself to state taxation. That would have been very short.
You were talking about your opinion. How do you handle the preemption issue, which you don't think is an issue, but what do you say about it?
There has to be some kind of explicit congressional preemption or a comprehensive congressional regulatory scheme in order to prevent state taxation of non-members of a tribe.
Because it's no invasion of sovereignty. Because you have a general rule that if it invades sovereignty, you can't do it.
Yes.
So after you're done with sovereignty, you'd have to go to the second one, and there is no such statute or preemption.
It's our position that there isn't.
All right.
Hopefully just about got this opinion written.
That would be good for both you and the court.
If there are no other questions, we would urge the court to follow the... Oh, one other thing I should point out. The legal incidence of the tax, which is something that was looked at in the sales and use tax cases, the legal incidence of an income tax is not on the tribe, but on the individual being taxed. So, you know, looking at the legal incidence of the tax does not lead to the conclusion that the tax is prohibited in this case.
That's true even if it's a member of the tribe.
That's correct, but there you, again, if you're infringing upon tribal sovereignty, you need express congressional authorization.
Which cases would you cite for your proposition that every federal and state case authorized state tax at a non-member on the reservation?
In our court of appeals brief, we have...
That's the one you're relying on.
Well, we have a number of cases cited. There's a number of Arizona cases, New Mexico, New Mexico is by regulation, but there's a federal bankruptcy case in Ray Smith where actually this specific fact situation is, or as close as you can get to this specific fact situation is presented.
Smith, which one is the Arizona one?
If I could...
I'm looking at your table of cases cited.
You have Dillon on page 24. You have a number of Arizona Department of Revenue rulings also on page 24. I don't know of any case that looking at Colville that has reached a contrary result, and I think that's also reflected in Judge Candy's treatise. In conclusion, we would urge the court to follow those decisions and to affirm the Court of Appeals and hold that states do have the power to tax non-member Indians residing on the reservation.
Carlton.
Okay, it's time to do the states. Montana. Supreme Court of Montana held in 1978 in the LaRock case that a non-member Indian's income earned in Indian country was not taxable by the state. And it reaffirmed that decision in 1992 in State v. Byrd. That is cited in the petitioner's brief. North Dakota. White Eagle v. Dorgan. The North Dakota Supreme Court.
Are you cited in here?
Yes,
okay,
yes they are, 1973. You also have Idaho's 1998 case in Ray Mettler, and in fact Idaho has codified their position on this issue in their tax instructions, stating that income earned off the reservation cannot be deducted, nor can income earned on the reservation if you live off the reservation. There's the bright line rule, and in fact Oregon has... more recently, 1997 codified this particular rule. This exempts any income derived from sources within the boundaries of a federally recognized Indian country by an enrolled member of a federally recognized American Indian tribe residing in federally recognized Indian country. That is the bright line test that we are asserting that Wisconsin should adopt today, rather than the rules utilized by Arizona and New Mexico. And in fact, looking at Arizona and the way Arizona has developed its case law in this area, you can see where the Supreme Court's reticence to have this kind of a rule, where this plays out when the Supreme Court said that litigation would surely engulf the states. Arizona has put the predominant case law in this area. We found six cases specifically on this issue, most of them by the Arizona Board of Tax Appeals. And Roma versus Arizona is especially telling. It's a 1993 case in which the Arizona Tax Board had to review the treaty that created the Colorado River Indian Reservation to determine if it included members of the Ketchin tribe, because that particular reservation had been set aside for five different tribes. And so what the Arizona Tax Board had to do was then look at the treaty language to determine whether or not the particular taxpayer, Ms. Romo, fell within their guidelines, because Arizona takes the position that you must be a member of the controlling sovereign in Indian country. But of course, what does that mean? What does it mean to be the controlling sovereign of the Indian country, to be an enrolled member of the controlling sovereign in a particular case? For example, if you look at the Chippewa tribes in Wisconsin, there are six bands of Chippewa in Wisconsin. Would the state then include all bands of Chippewa as part of, they used to all be one tribe. In Minnesota, there are 10 bands of Chippewa. And in fact, the Supreme Court noted in its Bryan ruling that Mr. Bryan was a member of the Minnesota Chippewa without any specific reference to what band of Chippewa Mr. Bryan belonged to in that case. The Supreme Court has not made those distinctions between tribal affiliation when it's dealing with income taxation. Sales taxation cases are different because the tribe itself is not conferring the privilege of domicile to anyone. And that's why the sovereignty of the tribe is not impacted to the same extent that it is in income taxation cases, where you're not only talking about the privilege of domicile, the privilege of residence, but you're also talking about the reservation land itself, income derived from reservation land. And actually, to get back to Justice Crook's question regarding the presumption, in Bryan v. Itasca County, the Supreme Court specifically noted that the rule of federal reluctance to interfere with state taxation is reversed when assessing the state's power to tax Indians or Indian property.
What's your citation?
It's Bryan v. Itasca. I don't have the, it's a 1980 case. I don't have the specific cite for that. I apologize. It's in our petitioner's brief. In conclusion, the petitioner, Joan Lurock, would request that this court enunciate a bright line test in conformance with Congress's plenary actions and authority over the relationship between Indian tribes and the federal government, that Indians be free from state interference and state jurisdiction when they are within Indian country, and especially when they are deriving their income from Indian country. We would ask that this court enunciate a bright line test that Indians of any federally recognized Indian tribe that reside in Indian country within the state and derive their income from Indian country are exempt from state income taxation. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. That concludes our hearing on 99-0951, LaRock versus Wisconsin Department of Revenue. We are in recess until 9:45 tomorrow morning.